Well, hello everybody. My name is Christopher Robinson, and I'd like to say, first of all, how thankful I am to be here tonight. We had a little discussion in the hallway about how Le Guin ought to be better known in France than she is, so it's a wonderful opportunity to have a moment to speak about her. So Le Guin is a truly wonderful writer. She's an engaging storyteller, a supreme stylist, and a visionary thinker. And just about 6 weeks ago, she was awarded the Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters by the National Book Foundation. That's probably one of the highest honors that can be bestowed upon an American writer. And I think it's all the more wonderful because, to my knowledge, she is the first writer associated with science fiction and fantasy to receive such an award. Now, the topic that we will be discussing tonight is a very rich one, anthropological science fiction. And it's so rich, in fact, that when I completed all the work and everything I wanted to say about the topic, I realized that I had about 2 hours worth. And so I was asked to keep it down to 45 minutes, so I've had to cut. And therefore, I just want to insist this is really an introduction. It's just a taste to of the subject and what we can find in Le Guin's work. I would also like to call attention to the fact that there has been some criticism of the very idea of anthropological science fiction by anthropologists themselves. As I began preparing for tonight, I came across, for example, this review by an anthropologist who says that just because a story has anthropologist as protagonist or makes vague references to culture does not qualify it as anthropological science fiction, although it may be pop anthropology. Well, I think we can all agree that, yes, just having an anthropologist so-called doesn't make it anthropological fiction. But what if that figure is treated with credibility and fidelity? Now, another question that comes up is, does the writer have to be a professional anthropologist to achieve that kind of believability? And once again, we find an anthropologist who seems to think so. So, Professor Collins says, Ursula K. Le Guin is not an anthropologist. There, I said it. Whenever I write anything about anthropology and science fiction, I invariably get comments like, why don't you write more about Le Guin? Her father is Alfred Kraber, you know. Collins then goes on to talk about another science fiction writer who was a professional anthropologist, whose name was Chad Oliver. Now, his critique of Le Guin does not prevent him from subtitling his essay, Making New Connections with Science Fiction's Anthropologist. So he does recognize there is some value there. But I think these are valid criticisms, and I kept them in mind as I was preparing for tonight. And I would like to just suspend them until the end, and we'll let you see what you think after we've had a little bit more of an introduction to Le Guin about these kind of critiques. Now, since we are limited on time, I'm going to keep the background information on Le Guin to a minimum, but I do think it is worth talking about Alfred Kraber. Who was Alfred Kraber? Well, Le Guin's father has been called the greatest American anthropologist of the 20th century. He had a major impact upon anthropology both as a science and as an academic discipline. He is to the United States what Claude Lévi-Strauss is to France. Now, it was thanks to Kraber that Le Guin was introduced to Native American culture at a very early age. She owes something as well to her mother, Theodora Kraber, who wrote several books on Native American culture, including one called Ishi in Two Worlds. The book became an instant classic, and one critic says that it was partially responsible for developing the interest in the 1960s for Native American culture or rather rediscovery, a utopian rediscovery of Native American culture. So Le Guin grew up in an environment that, in fact, was multicultural, that was polyglot. Her father spoke several languages and had many visitors to the house speaking those languages, including German. And speaking of the influence of her parents, Le Guin once said, "I think most of the influence they have had is temperamental, inherited, like a willingness to get outside of your own culture. My father felt very strongly that you can never actually get outside of your own culture. All you can do is try. I think that feeling sometimes comes out in my writing. My father studied real cultures, and I make them up. In a way, it's the same thing." Now, this quotation has been cited again and again by critics who would like to make a connection between Le Guin and anthropology. But I have to admit, the first time I read it, I wasn't convinced. The analogy between studying real cultures and inventing cultures just didn't seem very credible to me at first. But if we go a little bit further into what she's saying, and we look at another statement, this time by somebody else, I think we can find a truth in what she's getting at. Now, while some of the interest in anthropology in its earlier stages was in the exotic and the out of the way, yet even this antiquarian motivation ultimately contributed to a broader result. Anthropologists became aware of the diversity of culture. They began to see the tremendous range of its variations. They became aware of culture as a universe, or vast field, in which we of today and our own civilization occupy only one place of many. The result was a widening of a fundamental point of view, a departure from an unconscious ethnocentricity toward relativity. This shift from naive self-centeredness in one's own time and spot to a broader view based on objective comparison is somewhat like the change from the original geocentric assumption of astronomy to the Copernican interpretation of the solar system and the subsequent still greater widening to a universe of galaxies. Well, that statement was written by Le Guin's father, and I think it's probably the most succinct statement of cultural relativity that we can find. And I think that it's there that we're going to find the truth of her statement concerning her own work and her father's. What it indicates is that this concept of cultural relativity, which had a major impact not only on anthropology but on Western culture in general, it indicates that the only way to arrive at such an objective view of culture and humanity in general is to overcome one's own ethnocentrism by way of comparison and contrast of world cultures. And as Le Guin pointed out, we can never achieve this entirely. We can only try. But that's, I think, where the truth of her statement concerning the influence resides. It's in that very effort. Both Craver's anthropology and Le Guin's science fiction incite us to step outside of our own cultures, outside of our own worldview. Well, in what follows, I would like to keep this commonality of purpose in mind as we examine how Le Guin adopts the perspective of an anthropologist in writing about imaginary cultures, and how she invites us to observe not only her own imaginary worlds, but also the world in which we as readers live with the eyes of an anthropologist. And that means three things. First, it means looking at the world with a profound sense of cultural relativism. Second, it means with a process of self-scrutiny, reflection, awareness of how our own culture and our own language influence our observations, our analyses, our conclusions. And finally, with an eye to drawing contrast and comparisons with other cultures, including imaginary ones, including the reader's own, so as to arrive at conclusions about culture and humanity in general, to better understand the world we live in, also to better understand and relate to different peoples, and finally to strive for a better world. No. Just a few words about anthropology as a scientific discipline. There are four domains of anthropology. These were first established in the late 19th century, early 20th century, by Franz Boas, who was Alfred Kraber's teacher and dissertation director. And the four domains were distinguished by their objects of study, which in the 19th century meant physical anthropology for the study of skeletons, archaeology for the study of artifacts, linguistic anthropology for the study of languages, and in that context, it meant predominantly Native American languages, and cultural anthropology for the studies of culture. Now, my original outline was to use each of those domains with a separate novel, with a separate topic, etc. But I've had to choose just one, which covers most of them, except for archaeology tonight. But we'll see that each domain has its distinctive objects of study, its methodologies, its theories and concepts. But there's a lot of overlap and a lot of connections between them in the scientific world, but also in the left hand of darkness, as we'll see. Now, in cultural anthropology, the concept of cultural relativity gave birth to a new methodology, one that rejects speculation in favor of empirical investigation and the collection of data based on firsthand observation rather than reading secondhand accounts by travelers, missionaries, traders, and so forth. It's what we call participant observation. And participant observation involves three steps. The first is immersion. That means taking the time, 6 months, 2 years, 20 years, to get immersed physically, socially, linguistically into a particular culture and the group of people the anthropologist wishes to study. It means establishing rapport. It's very important for the observer to find acceptance into the group and also to develop individual relationships with members of that group and to make them feel comfortable enough so that they're at home having somebody watching them, but also asking them questions about things that are sometimes very personal, very intimate, or very secret. A third step is the collection and analysis of data. This involves interviews, individual and collective discussions, drawings, diagrams, making photographs, films, etc. It also involves reading, for example, people's life histories, again, first-hand accounts. And very importantly, it involves keeping a journal of the observer's own feelings and experiences. As one handbook for ethnographers points out, you absolutely need a diary in an ethnography project. It will help you deal with loneliness, fear, and other emotions that make fieldwork difficult. A diary chronicles how you feel and how you perceive your relations with others around you. Later on, during data analysis, your diary will become an important professional document. It will give you information that will help you interpret your field notes and will make you aware of your personal biases. So I want to underscore two things here. First of all, keeping a diary can help field workers alleviate emotional and physical strain due to what is called culture shock. This was a term first introduced by anthropologists in the 1960s. And originally, what it meant was the uncomfortable stress experienced by anthropologists who find themselves in a foreign culture. Among the feelings that were reported by anthropologists was the feeling that nothing seems right, that the people whom the observer is studying don't want that person around, and the anxiety about the observer's ability to collect good data. Now, the second thing I want to underscore is how self-analysis can aid participant observers to think about their own cultural baggage and how their own prejudices and biases can influence what they observe, what they analyze, or how they analyze, and finally the kind of conclusions that they draw. Now, in Le Guin's fiction, we find the figure of the participant observer in a number of her novels, actually in her very first, Buchanan's World. It's kind of a blend between fantasy and science fiction. But the protagonist, Buchanan, is an anthropologist. Yet Le Guin rarely uses the word ethnographer or anthropologist. Rather, her characters are called observers, mobiles, and envoys, all of whom have been sent by an organization called the Ecumen, whose goal is to promote interplanetary communications, progress, and cooperation. Now, moving more into The Left Hand of Darkness, I'd like to say just a few words about biological anthropology, because one of the fascinating things about the novel is the biology. Also, this is important because Le Guin, apparently the only class that she took in anthropology at university was in physical anthropology. So perhaps we see a bit of influence of that here. Biological anthropology focuses on human variation, that is, differences in anatomy, differences in appearances, and also the evolution of those differences over time. Also very important, they look at how the environment and culture influence anatomy and genetics. Now, we're going to see in The Left Hand of Darkness that Le Guin gives some attention to anatomical variations and their details, but she is ultimately more interested in the cultural impact of these differences and the perception of the differences in question. So there's a brief passage where we discover that I'm assuming you know a little bit about her universe. It's based upon a diaspora by a group of people from a planet called Hain. Actually, I was going to talk about this, but we really don't have time. It resembles a little bit what's called the Out of Africa theory of human evolution. There are two waves of the diaspora that took place, as with the African theory. And the idea is that the people from Hain spread out, colonized a number of planets in the universe, but the Federation broke down, and eventually the people forgot their heritage, forgot their origins. In some cases, there were genetic variations that took place. It's never clear why. It could have been due to experimentation. It could have been due to natural selection. Nobody's really sure. But at any rate, at another point, there was a league of all worlds which developed out of 9 planets, which somehow managed to get back together. They were attacked by a different type of species, a non-human species called the Xin. There is resistance, they fought back, and eventually, thanks to the discovery of nearly as fast as light travel, and to instantaneous communication with an instrument called the Ansible, whose discoverer, we're talking a little bit about the dispossessed, that's where this Churton theory of physics is discovered. Thanks to that, the Ecumen is formed, and eventually, the Ecumen will include 84 planets, the planet of Geffen, or Winter, which is where the Left Hand of Darkness takes place, is the 84th. So, what we discover in the Left Hand of Darkness is that there are different appearances of the people descended from Hain. The colors of skin, hair, and eyes reflect the real-life varieties found here on Earth, with the exception of the people of Athshi, who are green. We find that the shades range from very pale to very dark, again, as we know them here on our planet. And there are also differences with respect to hair. The Chifawarians are hairless as Chihuahuas, while the Athshians are covered entirely with fur. Now, anatomical differences include the fact that the Hainish are tall and slim, the Ketians are short and stocky, And the Athshins are about a meter tall. And the word for world is forest. Again, we have to find out what the translation for that is in French. We find an
monde des forêts.
Very good. There are some interesting comments, again, by an anthropologist, of the reaction of Terran colonists to the Athshins. And we read, quality is an important matter, but so is quantity, relative size. The normal adult reaction to a very much smaller person may be arrogant, or protective, or patronizing, or affectionate, or bullying, but whatever it is, it's liable to be better fitted to a child than to an adult. When the child-sized person was furry, a further response got called upon, which Lyubov had labeled the teddy bear reaction. Now, the teddy bear reaction is a real and genuine reaction, as we have proof of. And I think it's The Empire Strikes Back. Is this Empire Strikes Back? There are actually a lot of connections between the planet of Endor and Athshi, to the point that the names used are all bisyllabic in both novels. Interestingly, Le Guin herself doesn't catch the connection. She's written several critiques of Star Wars, and she never makes the connection with her own work. I did see also somebody mentioned that Avatar might very well be indebted to the word for world as forest. But again, I would love to have gone into that, but we haven't much time. But what I did just want to point out is this is really what Le Guin is more interested in. She presents us with differences, but ultimately, she wants to look at reactions. Well, I think the planet and the people who are most fascinating to us in her work are the people of Gethem, the hermaphrodites, and the left hand of darkness. This is a novel, again, that most people consider as her masterpiece. It's the one that's had the most writing done upon it. And we find that the Gethinian reproductive cycle is indeed described in some detail. So there are three, I'll just give you a brief summary. The longest stage in the reproductive cycle is called soma, and it's one of sexual inactivity and latency. It lasts for about 21 to 22 days. So think about it, that's four-fifths of the month. Around the 18th day, hormonal changes initiate a second stage, and this is a form of estrus known as kimer. At first, the individual remains androgynous and incapable of physical coupling, although the sexual drive does intensify and becomes overpowering to the point that she is excused from all other social obligations. Now, in the an isolated Gethinian cannot become sexually active without a partner whose own hormones are triggered by the change and who will assume the opposite sex. In the culminant phase of kimer, sexual capacity and drive are at their height. If there is no pregnancy, both individuals will return to summer in a matter of hours. But if there is conception, then the female partner will undergo further changes. There will be an enlargement of the breast, a widening of the pelvis, and there will then be a period of gestation of 8.4 months. And this is followed by a period of lactation of 6 to 8 weeks. Now, after the child has been weaned, the mother will return to the normal state of soma, which is to say a state of androgyny, where there is no physiological habit. Indeed, so-called normal individuals have no predisposition to either sex. This means that an individual may be the mother of several children and the father of several more. Now, the reproductive cycle and sexuality of the Gethinians has an impact on their culture and society, but this impact is bracketed concerning only the state of kimer. That's because the imperative nature of estrus, which one Ecumen observer compares to an animal in rut, become so overwhelming that no other social obligations are required of them. But that's as far as it goes. So as far as as one first observer to the planet put it, everything gives way before the recurring torment and festivity of passion. This is easy for us, gendered people, to understand. What is very hard for us to understand is that 4/5 of the time, these people are not sexually motivated at all. Room is made for sex, plenty of room, but a room, as it were, apart. The society of Gethin and its daily functioning and its continuity is without sex. Consequently, there is no binary ordering of Gethinian society, no division between weak, strong, protected, protective, submissive, dominant, chattel owner, passive, active. And the question of the left hand of darkness is that. Some of you may have read, there's a French writer, Hélène Cixous, who wrote a book called, I think it was Le Regard de Méduse, where she talks about the binary ordering of metaphors in our society. And so we find that the feminine is associated with left, the masculine with right, darkness with the feminine, light with the masculine, moon, sun, etc., etc. And what Le Guin is trying to say is that, no, there are two hands. And so her Gethinian people represent both. Furthermore, life choices don't depend on gender. No individual is hampered by the imperatives of childbearing, as frequently happens in most gendered societies for women. And it's even speculated that the lack of continuous sexual activity reduces violence on a collective scale. Gethin has never known war. Now, these biological and sociological details give the left hand of darkness a sense of authenticity and plausibility that we demand of a good science fiction novel. But Le Guin's concern, once again, is upon the gendered perception of non-gendered beings, as we see the Gethinian hermaphrodites through the eyes of the protagonist, Ginli I. It's interesting to see that I has been identified on the back of a recent edition as an ethnologist, when in fact, if you look at some of the older editions, it doesn't say that at all. In fact, he is not identified as an anthropologist. He's an envoy. His mission is to convince the Gethinians to join the ecumen. Nonetheless, he must perform the task of observation, participation, and learn something of the culture to fulfill his mission. The problem is he turns out to be a rather incompetent participant observer. One of the problems is he never quite masters the key concept in Gethinian behavioral cults, which is known as Shif Rithor, and this leads to numerous misunderstandings and creates his inability to create rapport, either with a group or with individuals. The biggest problem of all, however, is his lack of self-reflection concerning his sexism. To be fair, I make some progress in understanding, if not mastering, the codes of Shif Rithor, and he also shows some awareness of how his masculine gender influences his behavior, as we see in these statements. Estevan is the person who will eventually accompany him after he's been imprisoned. Again, it shows how successful I has been, but Estevan will help him escape from prison and will turn out to be his best informant. If Estevan could lower all his standards of Shif Rithor, as I realized he had done with me, perhaps I could dispense with the more competitive elements of my masculine self-respect, which he certainly understood as little as I understood Shif Rithor. And then a little bit later, he, after all, had no standards of manliness, of virility, to complicate his pride. So here I admits his own masculine pride, which actually at times is what we used to call male chauvinism. Now, where he does not make any progress at all is overcoming this chauvinism. Indeed, what he sees in the Gethinians is mediated by his own sexist conceptions of gender. Though I had been nearly 2 years on Winter, I was still far from being able to see the people of the planet through their own eyes, which, let me just remind you, is what a participant observer is supposed to do. I tried to, but my efforts took the form of self-consciously seeing a Gethinian first as a man, then as a woman, forcing him into these categories so irrelevant to his nature and so essential to my own. What's more, he is at times even misogynistic, and he reiterates stereotypes. Listen to this. Estevan's performance had been all womanly, all charm and tact and lack of substance, specious and adroit. Was it in fact perhaps this soft, supple femininity that I disliked and mistrusted in him? And even the physical traits of the Giffenians are seen through a lens of gender. He thus speaks of his landlady, a voluble man. I thought of him as my landlady, for he had fat buttocks that wagged as he walked, and a soft, fat face, and a prime, spine, ignoble, kindly nature. He was so feminine in looks and manner that I once asked him how many children he had had. And the landlady replies he had never had any, but he had sired 4. And to that I concludes, it was one of the little jolts I was always getting. Cultural shock was nothing compared to the biological shock I suffered as a human male among beings who were 5/6 of the time hermaphroditic neuters. So what we see throughout the novel is that I confuses gender with sex. As in this passage and throughout the entire novel, we see the process of engendering at work. Again, let me take just a little paragraph to say that Le Guin was surprisingly very criticized by feminists when the novel first came out. At that particular point, feminism is what was in what was has been called the second wave. We're not going to go into those critiques. What I will just say is that Le Guin had anticipated by at least 15, maybe even 20 years, what has now come to be known as the third wave of feminism, or what we call gender studies, gender theory. And I think it's no mistake that in the mid-1990s, when gender theory hit academia in full force, the interest in Le Guin went up and up and up, and it's continued since the turn of the millennium. So, getting back to The Left Hand of Darkness, we find that while I show some reflection upon the issue of gender, he does not practice the necessary self-reflection required to overcome his own misogynistic prejudices, his own cultural baggage of having been brought up as a privileged, empowered male in an androcentric society. Now, Ginley speaks to us through his report, which resembles a diary more than a scientific report. And you recall that in ethnographical studies, the diary serves to help release emotions that allows the ethnographer to come to terms with his or her culture shock, so as to, but also to overcome hidden and unrecognized biases that can hinder observation and analysis. So the subjective expression ultimately helps to ensure greater objectivity in making, just in becoming more objective. The problem is Ginley doesn't go far enough. He doesn't enter into genuine introspection. And I would say that that work is rather shifted to the reader. It's the reader's job to complete that step of self-introspection, to question his or her own self about their prejudices, about gender and sexuality. Now, I think we find a clue for that in the name Ginley I. On her website, Le Guin points out that you can pronounce it I, that is, as I, or I, or as I, an expression of pain. Well, I think that that's a clue for us because the I can serve as a focalizer. In other words, it helps us to look through Ginley's eyes at the culture of Gethin. We see it through his eyes. At the same time, I serves as a surrogate, an avatar, if you will. Only we have to take, as I said, the next step, and only then, through our work, can we hope to overcome the shock that we're constantly being subjected to throughout the novel. Now, a good example of those kind of jolts, which might make us say, are grammatical, or rather ungrammatical statements such as this. Here we find errors in predication and in agreement, which are sprinkled throughout the text. So, the king was pregnant. The physician, a grave, maternal young fellow. Again, these are meant to jolt us from our habits. One point, however, where Le Guin was criticized, and again, here we come to the critique of the feminist of the second wave, was the use of pronouns. I himself draws attention to this. Wiping sweat from his brow, the man, I must say, having said he and his. And in fact, Le Guin had to struggle with pronouns. She thought about them, she tried a lot of different variations, and then in the end she just said, well, he is neuter. Well, she was attacked for that, and in the end she conceded she had made a mistake. A few years later she wrote, the left hand of darkness is haunted and bedeviled by the gender of its pronouns, a wild, fierce, and intractable tribe. Having invented a race of people who are essentially sexless, except for a few days a month, what was I to call them? In 1967, when I wrote the book, I called them all he. I believed then that the masculine pronoun in English was genuinely generic, including both male and female reference. This is unpleasant, an unpleasant and inconvenient belief. Unfortunately, the more you look at it, the less credible it becomes. But as for going back and changing the actual text of a book written 25 years ago, rewriting it with hindsight, no. That would be cheap. The book stands. I stand with it, and with its many, many readers, who have not allowed the obstinacy of pronouns to keep them from the vision of genderless justice, or the dream of two as one. Now, with this last sentence, I think she underscores what I'm trying to point out here, which is that the role, that the reader has to play a very important role in the text. So, what we have to ask ourselves is whether or not, other than the pronouns, Le Guin gives us sufficient means to reflect on our own biases and to step outside of them to conceive of the Gathenians as a race of people who are essentially sexless for a few days per month. And if she fails with pronouns, she does counterbalance this with the other types of statements, those strangely ungrammatical yet readable statements such as the king was pregnant. To also help the reader along, she uses what I mentioned, the focalizer. In narratology, focalization describes how the text brings the readers into the consciousness of a given character. Again, we see what's happening through a particular character's eyes. We're made aware of that character's thoughts and emotions, even as we go along in the plot. So Ginley I, for example, was a Terran human, and like the majority of Le Guin's readers in 1967, he is male, and not overly concerned with issues related to gender. Again, one of the things that was very important about this novel is it really opened the door not only to female readers, but also to female writers, many of whom recognize the important influence that Le Guin played for them in going into the genre of science fiction. So, this is a type of character that the standard reader of 1967 of science fiction would have sympathized with. But in the case of Ginley I, the observer, not the informant, is presented as an alien. Whence comes my title. In other words, what the tables are turned around, and what is presented as normal is actually abnormal. So, working hand in hand with this strategy of turning the tables, of making the observer, the Terran observer, male observer, an anomaly, we have something that's called reverse ethnocentrism and reverse ethnography. With reverse ethnocentrism, the norms of Terran culture are viewed through the self-centered lens of a people whose norms are entirely different. Thus, Ginley I, a heterosexual male, is known as the pervert throughout Geffen. In his interview with the Mad King of Carhide, the king says, "I don't know what the devil you are, Mr. I, a sexual freak or an artificial monster." I retorts that, well, of the 84 known worlds, Geffenian physiology is unique among human beings. To which the king replies, "So all of them out on these other planets are in permanent kimmer? A society of perverts? Well, it may be a fact, but it's a disgusting idea, Mr. I. And I don't see why human beings here on Earth should want any dealings with creatures so monstrously different." Le Guin, so that's a good example of ethnocentrism, reverse ethnocentrism. But she also gives us, 30 years before the term was actually introduced into anthropological literature, an example of what is called reverse ethnography. And we find this in the Journal of Estefan, who, as I said, will eventually become, actually through Estefan's efforts, he will become I's informant. But the idea of reverse ethnography is that the informant views the observer and makes observations about the observer and his or her culture. And so in the Journal of Estefan, we find this. "There is a frailty about him. He is all unprotected, exposed, vulnerable, even to his sexual organ, which he must always carry outside of himself." Now think about it. I was probably, in a usual Terran solution, very proud of the organ that he was carrying around outside of himself. And that would be, for him, a symbol, a phallic symbol, of strength and power. But on this world, it makes him vulnerable. Then Estefan comments, "As I am Kimmer, I would find it easier to ignore I's presence, but this is difficult in a two-man tent. The trouble is, of course, that he is, in his curious fashion, also in Kimmer. A strange, low-grade sort of desire it must be, to be spread out over every day of the year and to never know the choice of sex. But there it is, and here I am. Here am I. Tonight, my extreme physical awareness of him was rather hard to ignore. After all, he is no more an oddity, a sexual freak, than I am. Up here on the ice, each of us is singular, isolate. I is cut off from those like me, from my society and its rules, as he is from his. There is no world full of other Geffenians here to explain and support my existence. We are equals at last, equal, alien, alone." In these reflections, Estefan achieves what Alfred Kraeber was explaining, that the getting out of your own worldview, it's an example of ethno-decentrism, a reenactment of the Copernican Revolution in cultural and sexual terms. Okay. Well, this brings us up to our conclusion here. We'll be running out of time very shortly. I hope, again, just even focusing on one novel, that I've given you some idea of how Le Guin's fiction is informed by anthropology, its objects of study, methodologies, theories, and concepts, and above all, how the perspective of an anthropologist, how she employs that in her writing, and how she incites the reader to adopt that. Let me just remind you that that means a sensitivity to cultural relativism, it means a self-reflection on one's own cultural baggage, and it means an eye to drawing contrast and comparisons with other cultures to arrive at a deeper understanding of culture and humanity in general, to foster communication between different peoples, and also to help build a better world. In the end, it's this common perspective that unites the aims and objectives of an anthropologist like Kraeber and a sci-fi writer like Le Guin, who makes cultures up. Now, I'll just end by saying that to achieve the goal of building a better world, we first have to envision what such a world might be like. In other words, opening up to cultural relativity is a first step. To complete the process requires yet another opening, the possibility of change. There was a very insightful article written about Left-Handed Darkness by probably America's most preeminent academic critic, whose name is Frederick Jameson, who says that it's a vocation of science fiction to relax the reality principle that cripples and censors mainstream literature today. And so the function of science fiction is to open us up to alternative visions of a world that has elsewhere seemed to resist even imagined change. Now, in her comments on pronouns in Left Hand of Darkness, Le Guin gives us a vision of genderless justice. And so the first step in recognizing the possibility of a new way of life is to step outside of our own culture, ideology, to shift from this naive self-centeredness in our own time and spot to a broader view, as Craver said, and recognize that ours is not the only life way, that the path of social, political, and economic development we have taken is not inevitable, that alternative ways of living are possible. Ursula K. Le Guin helps us as readers to make that leap and imagining change, as her science fiction starts to present us with a vision of new worlds, of new ways of life, and in anticipation of a roundtable that will be taking place this Sunday, she helps us to envision as well new definitions of what it means to be human. So thank you. Thank you very much. I think... Est-ce qu'on a deux minutes pour questions? Oui, d'accord. Donc si vous avez peut-être même cinq minutes, je ne sais pas. Et si quelqu'un a des questions, je peux on peut faire en français si vous voulez.
Oui. Tout simplement, quelle lecture est-ce que vous conseilleriez sur Le Guin pour se documenter, pour en apprendre plus? Un livre, quelque chose, en français, en anglais?
Vous voulez dire un texte critique?
Beaucoup de critiques avaient été écrites dessus.
Oui.
Ça m'intéresse.
Jameson est très reconnu. C'est quelqu'un de très reconnu. Son livre, en fait, il a pris son titre de Always Coming Home. On n'a pas trouvé la traduction. Always Coming Home. On ne sait pas. Je ne sais pas s'il a été traduit en fait.
D'accord.
Je ne suis pas sûr. Mais bon, il y a un chapitre qui s'appelle An Archaeology of the Future, et donc c'est un livre qui s'appelle Archaeologies of the Future, et des lectures de Le Guin, Aldous et Philip K. Dick et d'autres. Sinon, sur le site web de Le Guin elle-même, il faut simplement taper Le Guin, site officiel, c'est pas mené par elle. Ça ne s'intéresse pas trop à la toile, mais le cercle proche de Le Guin a construit une bibliographie avec pas mal de livres. Et on peut trouver quelques-uns traduits en français. À ma connaissance, il n'y a pas une étude, un monographe sur Le Guin en français. Quand j'ai fait ma thèse sur elle, c'était la première fois que quelqu'un avait fait une thèse sur Le Guin en France.
Vous nous conseillez votre thèse?
Ah, c'est sur Earthsea, Terre-Mère, c'est très académique, donc bon. Si vous voulez, vous pouvez m'écrire, je peux vous envoyer un petit extrait pour voir si éventuellement ça peut être intéressant.
I'm actually more familiar with the Earthsea part of
oui,
of the
yeah, yeah.
And I was wondering about, so there's such a huge influence of anthropology when you describe about the Left Hand of Darkness, and I feel it much less inclined in Earthsea novels. Is it like two different periods of her work? Did she move from one to the other back and forth? Is it just that I didn't pay attention to it in Earthsea?
Perhaps it wasn't as evident. She was indeed very much influenced by anthropological literature, and in particular, again, I've been meaning to write her to ask her this ever since I started working on this project, but I'm almost certain she was inspired by somebody I would have talked about tonight had I more time, who is Bronislaw Malinowski, one of the first great participant observers, and he wrote about people in Melanesia on an archipelago. Earthsea is an archipelago, and in particular he wrote about magic and words. So if you look, there are two main influences. Le Guin at school studied what we call Romance languages, so that would have included Italian and French in particular. And she was
Romance
interested in the Renaissance.
Seriously.
I'm
Romance
sorry?
Languages. It's called.
We call it Romance languages.
Yeah. Okay, Roman.
Exactly.
Romans.
And so that was her major at school. She actually came to France on a Fulbright scholarship to do a PhD on a French writer, Belgian, Franco-Belge writer. And so in Earthsea, you have the Renaissance influence, the alchemist and so forth, but you also have the more ethnographic influence by Malinowski and that vision of magic. Any other questions? D'autres questions?
Voilà. Yep. J'ai une remarque sur les pronoms dans la main gauche de l'ennemi, où elle a choisi d'utiliser toujours il.
Oui.
Et il y a un livre qui vient de sortir qui s'appelle Ancillary Justice, où tous les personnages sont elle. Et les critiques ont hurlé au scandale parce que, mon Dieu, mais alors les personnages ne sont pas hermaphrodites, sont hommes ou femmes. Mais on s'en fiche, c'est le pronom par défaut, c'est elle. Et tout le monde a dit que c'était insupportable de lire un livre où tout le monde est elle, y compris quand à un moment on te parle de sa barbe. Et c'est marrant, alors que c'est 30 ans après celui-là. Oui. Enfin, c'est.
Avec les noms.
Elle avait fait plusieurs expérimentations elle-même avec certains chapitres où elle avait essayé de faire des choses. Oui. Daniel, oui.
Pourquoi est-ce qu'elle n'a pas choisi, est-ce qu'il y a des explications pourquoi elle n'a pas choisi le mot « it »
Alors, peut-être parce que...
L'anglais permet qu'il blanchit en tout.
Parce qu'en anglais, « it », c'est un objet.
C'est un objet.
Du coup, c'est très, très méprisant d'utiliser pour quelqu'un.
Donc, merci beaucoup.
Merci à vous.
Voilà. Et bonne lecture.